This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to start today by listening to Terry's interview with Will Reiser and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Reiser wrote the new film comedy 50-50. It's based on his real-life, not-so-funny experience as a 20-something diagnosed with cancer. 50-50 premiered earlier this month at the Toronto Film Festival and stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Adam, the character based on Will Reiser. In this scene, Adam has invited his parents to dinner, where he intends to break the news that he has cancer. His girlfriend, who is very uncomfortable around sickness, is also at the table. She's played by Bryce Dallas Howard. Adam's mother, played by Angelica Houston, speaks first.
So, what's the special occasion?
Have you ever seen Terms of Endearment?
Mm-hmm. Adam, just tell her.
Tell me what?
I have cancer.
I'm moving in.
What? No. No, Mom, no.
I'm your mother,
no.
Adam.
No, exactly. That's why. And Mom.
Will Reiser, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, welcome to Fresh Air. Will, let me start with you. I bet when you were suffering with cancer, you weren't thinking, someday this pain is going to translate into a good comedy. In fact, a romantic comedy.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, 6 years ago when I was diagnosed and I had cancer, my closest friend at the time was Seth Rogen, and the way that we dealt with it was by finding the humor in the situation. And cancer aside, is we would always come up with just kind of ridiculous movie ideas. And while I was sick, we just kind of we floated the idea, you know, back and forth with one another, just the idea of doing a cancer comedy. But it was really just a joke. We wanted to do like a parody of The Bucket List, where you do like really absurd, ridiculous things like, you know, skydiving with hookers and just things that were just completely outlandish. But it was a joke, and that was really kind of it was a sort of a coping mechanism at the time. And for me, I would think about this movie from time to time when really absurd things would happen to me in my life, because the time when I was sick was actually probably the most absurd period of my life. And once I got better, that was when I actually started thinking, and Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg started really urging me to write the movie. But when I was actually sick, it was really kind of this place I would go in my head to kind of retreat from all the chaos, and I would just kind of think of where I could, you know, all the crazy things that were happening in my life, I would just think of, you know, a place where I could put all of that. But I never actually thought that this movie would be made.
So what kind of cancer did you have?
I had a massive tumor in my spine, and very similar to what Joe's character has in the movie. And Joe has a schwannoma neurofibrosarcoma, which is basically a tumor in the spine.
A cancerous tumor. Yeah.
It's a cancerous tumor that grows along the nerve sheath and then spreads out through the back and in between the vertebrae. And it's very messy.
So how is your spine affected from them disentangling the tumor from the spine?
Well, I had to go through a lot of intensive physical therapy. It probably took about a year to a year and a half till I was walking without, you know, a limp. But, you know, after the surgery, the doctor thought that I would never be able to run again. But 2 years later, I was jogging. So now, you know, 6 years later, I'm still in physical therapy, but I've pretty much fully recovered.
That's great. I'm really glad to hear that. Now, the movie raises a question that I think a lot of people have to face if they get really sick. Young people have to face it. You know, like people in their teens or 20s have to face it. People who are middle-aged have to face it. Like, if you're not married, and if you don't have, like, a real serious partner in life, who's going to help take care of you? Mm-hmm. And in your movie, the character is about 24?
He's 27.
27, okay.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, his mother, as we heard in the clip, his mother is like, oh, I'm going to move in, which he refuses to let happen. But so the question is like, is there a good friend who's going to take care of you? Are you going to invite a parent if you have one that's still living, a sibling, or, you know, what are you going to do? So how did you handle that? You know, in the movie, Seth Rogen kind of takes over that role of being the person who really sees you through it.
Yeah, I mean, in real life, Seth did play that role. He was sort of like my Patch Adams, you know, he definitely...
I mean, won't tell him you said that.
I tell him. I've told him, so it's okay. But, you know, my mom really wanted to take care of me, and I was in L.A. and she was in New York, and the moment I told her that I was diagnosed, she got on a plane and flew to L.A. We went to one doctor's appointment, and I just could not handle being babied. I just, you know, I was 25, and I was just, that's just, you know, at the age where I was really kind of finding my own independence, and the idea of having my mother take care of me just seemed so unbearable. So I put her on a plane and made her go back to New York, which just, I mean, that just, I, you know, she was really patient with me, but I did not treat her as well as I probably should have. That's reflected in the script and in the movie, you know, the relationship between Joe and Angelica. And how trying that is for them during that period. And that was exactly how it was for me, my mother and I. And it's hard, you know, at 25 to know how to ask for help from your mother because it's the person you're trying to break away from.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, I think at that age, it was hard for me to really ask for help from anybody. I think I wanted to feel as normal as much as I possibly could. So all I tried to do was just joke around and make everybody feel like it was, you know, everything was okay.
Sure, and then you get home from the hospital and you are so not normal.
Yes, exactly.
When you're recovering from the surgery, especially your kind of surgery. So who helped out then?
Well, I had a girlfriend at the time who helped. I had a nurse who came and helped.
The girlfriend didn't bail like in the movie.
the girlfriend character in the movie is fictional. She's sort of an amalgam of a few different people from my real life who did actually bail. You know, I think it's a really intense ordeal to go through, and some people just don't know how to handle it. And I think people, they don't know what to do, they don't know what to say, and they just don't know how to conduct themselves. And I think the idea of being around someone who's reflecting back their own fear of mortality, I think that just kind of sends people running away. And I definitely saw that in people who were very close to me, friends, family members. And so that was really hard. So I really tried to, you know, to take that and inject that into a character. And that's what I did with Rachel, was just, you know, the girlfriend who can't handle her boyfriend's cancer and just can't handle the pressure of being around someone who's sick.
There's a scene where Seth Rogen's character is trying to help the character that's your surrogate, the character played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And at Joseph Gordon-Levitt's insistence, Seth Rogen's going to change the bandage. And then Joe basically asks, did you wash your hands first? And, of course, Seth Rogen hasn't. And I thought, ha, that's kind of funny in the film. If that happened in real life, I would just be horrified. Just like absolutely horrified. Did you go through that?
Well, Seth did actually change my dressing, and he was incredibly squeamish. And he is very, despite what you might think about Seth, he is an incredibly, incredibly fragile human being who does not like the sight of blood or cuts or scrapes or anything like that. And for him, changing the dressing and seeing my giant wound was a really traumatic experience for him. But he did it. He did it. He just complained about it the whole time, much as he does in the movie.
So when you got sick, you were working on a comedy show. Were you working on L.E.G. then?
I got sick just after we wrapped, about 7 months after we wrapped on the second season of L.E.G. And when I was actually diagnosed, I was working on a VH1 comedy show called Best Week Ever. And that was right around the time I was diagnosed.
Was it hard to be working on a comedy show knowing how sick you were?
It was a great distraction. I just felt – I didn't feel well while I was at work. So that was really hard. I just kind of would have to labor through the day. But I think just being around funny people in general was a really great distraction from thinking about what I was actually going through. I did eventually have to take time off from work because – just of the magnitude of the surgery. I was incapable of actually, you know, getting in a car and going to work on a daily basis just because my body just needed to recover. But during the period, you know, there's a four-month period where I just had to keep going in for test after test in the hospital because they kept I was misdiagnosed. I was originally diagnosed with a terminal form of lymphoma, which was really horrible. And then after that, they just, you know, I kept getting passed along from doctor to doctor. And so that four-month period from when I was first diagnosed till I had my surgery, that was really when I was in this constant state of trying to avoid thinking about, you know, what the outcome of this cancer might actually be.
So in the movie, Seth Rogen suggests that you can use cancer as a pickup line, get girls' sympathy. Did you ever try that? Did he actually suggest that?
It was something we'd talk about a lot because people would give me a lot of sympathy. But it's really the kind of sympathy you give like a sick dog. It was less the sympathy you give like James Franco, you know, like I don't know what that means necessarily. But, you know, I mean, I wasn't like women suddenly found me really attractive because I had cancer. It was just that they felt bad for me. So it was kind of, it was pity sympathy. But
sex sympathy.
It wasn't sex sympathy, yeah. No, but I did introduce Seth to his fiance while I was sick. And I think that's probably why she's stuck around to this day.
How did you manage to do that?
She was friends with a girl I was dating. And we basically set them up.
Nice.
Yeah, and they're getting married 6 years later.
So he got something out of this thing.
He got something out of it. And it was while I was sick. We introduced Seth to Lauren, and I think it made Seth look like an incredibly sympathetic friend. Which he was, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Will Reiser, who wrote the new film 50/50 that's loosely based on his experience with cancer. And also joining us, and let me bring him into the conversation, is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who plays the character based on Will Reiser. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, of course, first became known for co-starring in Third Rock from the Sun. He went on to make Mysterious Skin, Inception, 500 Days of Summer, and soon will be in the next Batman movie. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Really glad to have you. So,
can I just have a gratuitous kiss-ass moment for a little second?
Hey, help yourself.
I grew up listening to NPR and public radio in my mom's car. My mom and dad actually met working at I don't know if you know this station, KPFK in LA. It's Pacifica Radio.
Yep.
It's public radio on the West Coast, and so I have a very fond place in my heart for what you do, and I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And I should say, are you responsible for the fact that your character in the movie works for Seattle Public Radio? Was that already written in when you took the part?
That was written in. I'm not responsible for that. But
well,
I can take responsibility
okay.
if that
I'll
if
take
that
credit
helps.
For it.
Okay. Well, why was it public radio that he works in?
Well, I've always felt really guilty about. I'm a huge supporter of NPR, and I've never given I've never pledged it or given a donation. I've always felt really guilty about, and then I figured this is the best way to donate some time back to NPR. It's the biggest donation I could possibly give, I think. So
that's
so
hysterical. That is really hysterical. Okay, so what are some of the things you wanted to know from Will as the writer of the movie and also as the guy who it's based on? Loosely based on, but based on.
Well, there were sort of two categories of questions that I would ask Wills. The less interesting category, but very necessary category, was more, I guess, medical or technical, just how it physically felt. I wanted to make sure that I looked like I was going through what he went through. And so I would ask him pretty detailed questions of what hurt, where, when, for how long, how badly, etc. And that was always really useful, especially because he was there on set every day, all day. So I could ask him really specific questions, like, if I'm sitting on these cement steps and I'm going to get up, how bad would that hurt? You know, and get a specific answer from him. I'm really pleased with how that part of the performance turned out. I think it's not hitting you over the head, but it looks real and accurate. And I think that's largely due to his credit. But the more interesting stuff that we would talk about was not medical at all. It was just, how did this feel? What were you thinking about? And that's really what the movie is about to me.
So, Joe, you had to shave your head right before you started losing. In the film, right before you start losing your hair from the chemo, you decide to just, like, shave it. Were you afraid of what you'd find once you were bald?
Well, to be honest, I had shaved my head in the past. There was one other time in my life where I had just got done playing a really heavy role in a movie called The Lookout, and I just wanted to shake it up, and I shaved my head. So maybe that alleviated any fears of the unknown, like you're talking
right.
about. But
actually, Joe looks really good bald.
Hey, thanks.
You're welcome. You have a really nice head.
Everyone kept saying that to me throughout the shoot, but I suspected they were just trying to make me feel better, that it was a bit of a conspiracy that everyone had been directed to say, like, make sure that you tell Joe that his head looks nice because, you know, he's walking around bald and we got to make him feel good about himself.
But, you know, you could shave your head and you could look just like a skinhead or something, but you didn't. You looked like a really nice, friendly person.
That was the cardigans.
So, Will, do you still have residual pain from the surgery or, you know, from the tumor that was removed?
I do. I have felt pain every day since the surgery, but every day that pain, you know, dissipates a little bit.
Because it mentally recedes or because it's actually going away?
Because it's going away. Because it's just my body's getting stronger and, you know, nerve endings are... I lost feeling in part of my right leg and they had to remove the psoas muscle on my right side, which is a really major muscle. And I've spent the last 6 years rebuilding that and, you know, building it back up. And because that muscle was, most of that muscle was removed, it meant that other muscles in my body had to take over. And those muscles were just, you know, incredibly strained the last 6 years. So teaching my body to kind of use new muscles has been part of that. And also just the nerves nerve endings growing back as well.
Just one more question. You know, when you're in your 20s, you really are finding your adult personality, mm-hmm. who you are, who you want to be. You can make certain adjustments. You're still a little flexible. But, you know, and at that time, suddenly you get sick. You get this, like, terrible diagnosis of this cancerous tumor that's growing around your spine. And then you become disabled for a while as a result of the surgery. You have to build yourself up over a period of years. So how much did I am sick, I am weak, I am in pain become a part of that new adult identity?
I think that there was less of the I am sick mentality versus more of the anger of feeling like, why did this happen to me? Versus, you know, while I was seeing my friends who were perfectly healthy, like, why? Just feeling like I had to take all these extra steps in my life to feel good, whereas they had it so much easier. But that was really, that was how I felt initially. I look back on it in a much different way now. I did feel I was a victim right after I went through the entire ordeal. But now I really, you know, I feel like I've really kind of processed that and moved on from mm-hmm. that period. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when it was really difficult and I sort of felt like who I was, you know, sort of entangled in this idea of being a sick person, for sure.
I could jump in with a bit of a third-party perspective on that question, too.
Sure.
And I wasn't there. I didn't know Will before he got sick, but I've gotten to know him quite well since then. And I've heard lots of stories from Will himself as well as from Seth and Evan about what Will was like before he got sick. And the way it's, at least I have it in my head, is the attitude you're describing of a bit of a, I am weak, I am in pain, that sort of victim's mentality, it seems describes Will much more before he got sick than afterwards. The Will that I know is like far from a complainer, far from that. He's a really strong, graceful guy. And that's, I think, a big part of the story that we wanted to tell with 50-50 is the character starts out as kind of neurotic, insecure, and then he goes through this ordeal, and by the end, he's loosened up, he's more able to sort of go with the flow. He's a stronger, happier person having gone through the challenge.
Well, Will, I really want to express my gratitude that you have had such a good recovery and that also you were able to get something good. You were able to find something of value from the experience of being really sick, that thing being this new movie, 50-50. So,
yeah,
you know,
thanks.
Congratulations
on
that.
Thank you so much.
That's really saying something.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's pretty incredible for me, you know, to take, you know, what was the most painful experience of my life and turn it into something that I'm really proud of and, you know, that I made with my friends. I think it's pretty great.
Will Reiser wrote the new film 50-50, which stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Reiser and Gordon-Levitt spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week. You'll find a longer version of their interview, which includes Joseph Gordon-Levitt talking about some of his other projects, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Low Cut Connie is a band formed by Adam Weiner from New Jersey and Dan Finnemore from Birmingham, England. They lead a quartet that has just self-released its first album called Get Out the Lotion. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's both a throwback to early rock and roll and a vital collection of raucous new music.
It becomes clear early on that Low Cut Connie are a bunch of talented musicians who pride themselves on their low-down, low-rent, low-minded methods and instincts. They like to sing about intercourse, inebriation, and an inability to have a good time. Recorded for what sounds like a suitably low budget, Low Cut Connie benefits mightily from the buzzsaw yowl of Adam Weiner. That's Rio, in which Adam Weiner sings of a night out with the boys that is so overloaded with testosterone, the guys nearly fall in love with each other before they even get to the girls and the drinking. I sincerely wish I could play the song in which Weiner gets ready for a big night out by performing his ablutions with a directness too blunt for radio and a big beat that just won't quit. But he does, worshipful party monster that he is, equate cleanliness with godliness. And that's probably the same deity he prays to in order to channel the 1950s rock and roll that motivates Johnny Coolman.
They call me Johnny Cool, Johnny, Johnny, Johnny Coolman. Johnny, Johnny, Johnny Coolman. The six has gone, they break my bone. But do it, they don't bother me. Woo! I was born for no one but you. Good God, I'm so into you. Don't you know it's true? Woo! They call me Johnny Cool, Johnny, Johnny, Johnny Cool Man. Call me Johnny, 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 Johnny Cool Man. The sticks has gone, they burn my bone, but the words, they don't bother me. Woo!
If Johnny Cool Man is Low Cut Connie's reach back to Jerry Lee Lewis modulated by doo-wop, Weiner's musical partner, Dan Finnemore, has his own British contribution to make. His Lover's Call is Nick Lowish whimsy with a skiffle rhythm that comes as close as these wise guys want to get to pure beauty.
Oh,
For all the contagious fun to be had listening to this out of left field, out of time collection, respect must be paid to Low Cut Connie's skills as creators of melodies that nearly always evince more purpose than the pounding boogie they frequently start out as. And their lyrics are deceptively simple. On a song such as Big Thighs, New Jersey, Wiener makes the pun, "Your lips were pierced with pain," carry the weight of a woozy romanticism. On this song, Show Your Face, he does a terrific job of compressing the pickup lines a guy uses to disguise a sincere desire to connect with a woman on a level deeper than a dance floor grind. It would be a mistake to oversell Get Out the Lotion, although with a title like that, I think Low Cut Connie does a good job all by itself of undercutting any grand ambitions. But over the course of 11 rockin' tunes, the band keeps expectations to a minimum in an artful way. They startle you with just how much juice, passion, and wit has gone into making this sound like spontaneous, thrown-together music.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Get Out the Lotion, the self-released introductory album from Low Cut Connie. All the music, interviews, and reviews you hear on Fresh Air are available on our website, freshair.npr.org, including a recent interview and performance with Nick Lowe. He's currently on tour and performed this version of his song House for Sale when he stopped by our studio. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
House for sale. I'm moving out. I'm moving on. This bird has flown. House for sale. I'll tell you where to redirect my mail. House for sale. Take a look inside. This is where love once did reside. But now it's gone, and that's the reason I'll be traveling on. Well, the roof's given in to the weather, and the windows rattle and moan. Paint is peeling, cracks in the ceiling. Whatever's happened to my happy home? House for sale. I've had enough. I'll send a van to get my stuff. House for sale. I'm leaving like I'm getting out of jail. The stairs are alarmingly shaky, and the carpet threadbare and worn. Fence needs mending, garden needs tending. How soon it's become overgrown. Whoa, house for sale. I've had enough. I'll send a van to get my stuff.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Now let's listen to part of Terry's recent interview with actor Aaron Paul. He plays Jesse Pinkman in the impressively intense AMC series Breaking Bad, which is now in its fourth season. When the series began, Pinkman was a teenager, a failing young slacker who was cooking and selling meth on a small scale. Pinkman then partnered with his former chemistry teacher, Walter White, played by Bryan Cranston, after Walter was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. At first, Walter needed the ill-gotten money for his treatment and to build the nest egg he hoped to provide for his family. But instantly, Walter discovered he was really, really good at something. Specifically, at concocting a recipe for top-quality meth that quickly becomes legendary. In this scene from the first season of Breaking Bad, Walter and Jesse have recently teamed up. Jesse was supposed to sell the batch of meth they'd just cooked together and bring back the money. When Jesse shows up late, Walter is angry.
We were supposed to start at 3.
Hey, I'm out there making fat stacks, man. Chill. Hey, prepaid cell phone. Use it.
How much is this?
26 big ones.
Is that all? $26,000?
No, that's $2,600. And your share is $13. Minus $25 for that phone.
How much meth did you sell?
Nearly an ounce.
Last time I checked, there were 16 ounces to a pound. What'd you do with the rest? Smoke it?
Yo, I've been out there all night slinging crystal. You think it's cake moving a pound of meth 1/10 at a time?
So why are you selling it in such small quantities? Why don't you just sell the whole pound at once?
To who? What do I look like, Scarface?
This is unacceptable. I am breaking the law here. This return is too little for the risk. I thought you'd be ready for another pound today.
You may know a lot about chemistry, man, but you don't know jack about slinging dope.
Well, I tell you, I know a lack of motivation when I see it.
Oh, my God.
You've got to be more imaginative, you know? Just think outside the box here. We have to move our product in bulk, wholesale. Now, how do we do that?
What do you mean, to like a distributor?
Yes. Yes, that's what we need. We need a distributor. Now, do you know anyone like that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to, until you killed him.
Aaron Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. I love that scene.
Thank you so much.
And I love the way your former chemistry teacher, who's now your partner cooking meth, is lecturing you about your lack of motivation the way only a teacher could. Now, your character, Jesse, was supposed to be killed off in the first season of Breaking Bad. How did you find out that your character was doomed? When did you learn that?
I didn't learn that until towards the end of the first season. We were on the sixth episode, so the fifth episode plus the pilot, and we had one more to go, and I hadn't read the script yet. And Vince, we were at lunch, and Vince is...
This is the creator, Vince Gilligan.
Yeah, this is creator Vince Gilligan, calls me over, and he's, you know, eating with all the writers, and he goes, "I want to tell you something." And I go, "What's that?" And he goes, "You know, originally Jesse was supposed to die at the end of this season." And this is the first time I've ever heard any of this. And instantly my heart kind of dropped and slowed down a bit. And he goes, "But we don't think we're going to do that anymore." And I was like, "What do you mean? What are you talking about? Like, what's the plan?" And he's like, "No, we just I just want to let you know that that's not the plan anymore." And I didn't know how to take it, but he said that they just love the dynamic between Walt and Jesse and the chemistry that Bryan and I kind of brought to these characters. He decided to change the whole dynamic of their relationship and really of the show, but the entire second season, the entire third season, I thought that Jesse could be a goner at any moment, because there's many things that this character has screwed up on, and he could definitely meet his deathbed at any moment. So. And they'd always tease me. They'd always joke around saying, "Oh, did you read the next script?" And I would say, "No, not yet. I haven't got it. I haven't got it." And, Bryan would come up and give me a hug and say, "Well, I'm not going to say anything, but, you know, it was such a pleasure working with you. it's been an amazing past year and a half, and you know, you have a huge career ahead of you, and so they would always joke around about it. They kind of slowed down this fourth season, but we'll see. Who knows? I mean, this kid could die at any second.
Well, when I interviewed Vince Gilligan, he basically said he couldn't imagine the series without you.
Oh, I love that man. How nice is he?
But they also made it clear that's no guarantee. So, but you know, that kind of uncertainty, I could see that being a little helpful because Jesse's never sure how long he's going to live. So
right.
Why should you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
Jesse's changed so much in the course of the now four seasons of the show. And, you know, he starts off really small time. You know, he's almost like still a kid. And now he's involved with this big drug ring and where there's a lot of violence, a lot of money. At the end of season three, last season, Walt is afraid that the head of the drug ring is going to kill him as soon as Walt has finished training his assistant cook, a man named Gale, in how to prepare the meth recipe. And if the head of the drug ring kills Walt, he'll probably kill Jesse too. So Walt thinks the only hope is to have Jesse kill this assistant meth cook, Gale. So he convinces Jesse that Jesse has to murder the assistant cook. And so you, Jesse, kill Gale, and then you just really become dead inside afterwards. So you kill him, you're dead inside, you start using meth again, and then you end up going to your support group, your drug support group. You want to confess that you've killed a man, but you can't confess that. So you make up a story that you've killed a dog. And here's a clip from that scene in the support group.
A couple weeks back, I killed a dog. You hit it with your car? No, I put him down. I watched him go. I was looking them straight in the eye. And he didn't know what was happening. He didn't know why. He was just scared. And then he was gone.
And then members of the support group try to comfort Jesse, and one of them says, oh, well, the dog was suffering. Putting him down was a kindness. And then when Jesse says, that's not what happened, the woman in the group assumes, oh, well, the dog must have bitten someone, so you did the right thing. And then you say it wasn't that. And then another person in the group assumes, like, well, you must have started using meth again, and that took you to the dark side, because that's what meth does. And everybody's trying to help you justify killing this dog. And you know that there's really no justification for what you've done, which is killing a man. So let's pick up the scene from there, and the leader of the support group speaks first.
How'd you feel about what you did, Jesse?
I don't know.
Who cares how you feel? What kind of a person kills a dog for no reason?
Colleen.
You put an ad in the paper? You drop him off at
Colleen.
A shelter. You don't just sit there and talk about killing a helpless, innocent
Colleen.
Animal.
We're not here to sit in judgment.
Why not? Why not? Maybe she's right. You know, maybe I should have put it in the paper. Maybe I should have done something different. The thing is, if you just do stuff and nothing happens, what's it all mean? What's the point? Oh, right, this whole thing is about self-acceptance.
Kicking the hell out of yourself doesn't give meaning to anything.
So I should stop judging and accept.
To start.
So no matter what I do, hooray for me because I'm a great guy, it's all good. No matter how many dogs I kill, I just... Or do an inventory and accept? I mean, you back your truck over your own kid and you, like, accept? What a load of crap.
Hey, Jesse, I know you're in pain.
No, you know what? why I'm here in the first place is to sell you meth. You're nothing to me but customers. I made you my bitch.
You okay with that? Huh? You accept?
No. About time.
That's my guest, Aaron Paul, as Jesse Pinkman in a scene from this season of Breaking Bad. You've taken a lot of punishment in the series. You've been beaten in a lot of very imaginative ways. What are some examples of the worst beatings you've taken in the series?
Oh, wow. Well, some of the worst beatings really came at the very beginning, which was done by a character named of Tuco, this guy played by Raymond Cruz, and he's just this very loud, violent drug dealer who's addicted to meth. And there was this one scene where he's beating me up with a bag of money and beating me to a bloody pulp. And that's the first time Jesse goes to the hospital in the series. And then the next time that he got beaten up by Tuco, really, Tuco is about to put a shotgun to his face and pull the trigger, and he throws Jesse out of this house. And in one of the takes, probably on the eighth or ninth take, my head actually comes into contact with the opening of this wooden screen door, and I catch it, and my entire body flips around, and it splits the screen door into a million pieces, and I just land flat on my like head and chest. And the scene continues to go on because he thinks that I'm just acting, but in reality, I was just completely out of it, and I don't remember it happening. And I ended up getting this pretty serious concussion, and felt like, yeah.
I thought you meant the character thinks you're acting. You mean the actor thinks you were just acting.
Raymond Cruz thought that I was still just in the moment. But then there's a point where he picks me up, puts me on his shoulders, and he was going to slam me against the wall. And I try to grab him and just tell him, you know, to tell him to stop. And so they shut down production for a little bit. Ambulance was called, and they sent me to the hospital. I was saying I was fine, but I just felt a little drunk, to be honest. It was just so strange that it just, you know, ended up going to the ER and spent about 6 or 7 hours with one of our executive producers.
Your co-star, the star of the series Breaking Bad, is Bryan Cranston. Did you know him from Malcolm in the Middle? I mean, from watching him on Malcolm in the Middle, in which he played the father?
Oh, yeah, I loved him. I loved that show. I thought he was great.
And how old were you when you first started watching that?
Oh, man, I was in L.A. When they were casting that pilot. I remember reading that pilot, and I went out for the older brother. Didn't end up getting it, obviously.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah. Chris Masterson ended up getting the role, and he was brilliant on it. But, yeah, I was a huge fan of that show from day one. I think I've probably seen pretty much every episode. But my mom is the biggest Malcolm in the Middle fan. She's obsessed.
Maybe that helped ease the blow that you're going to play somebody who cooks meth in the series.
Yeah, exactly. When I told her that Bryan Cranston was the star of Breaking Bad, the pilot that I had just booked, she lost her mind. She was so excited because she knew one day she would be able to meet him, you know? So she was ecstatic.
So you're obviously very different from the Jesse Pinkman character that you play on Breaking Bad. In fact, you know, he's a meth head. You grew up in Idaho. Your father is a Baptist minister, yes?
Yes, yeah. He's actually retired. He doesn't have a church he does every week anymore, but he still does, you know, weddings and funerals and sometimes we'll guest speak at some churches. But yeah, throughout my entire life growing up in Idaho, we would go to his congregation every week, and he would preach. And
what was his preaching like?
Yeah. It was great. It was inspiring, really. I mean, he would get up in front of all these people and kind of just get lost in the moment as well. And I think that's where I take, not that I'm saying he was really standing up there acting, but he would just really get lost into these stories he would speak, and it was fun to watch and to hear. And I left at such a young age.
Left Idaho and left home?
Left Idaho, yeah. I left Idaho at 17. I graduated high school a year early and just, the typical story, packed up my car and moved out.
When you left home at age 17, which, as you point out, is really young, did your parents try to, bar the door and do everything in their power to prevent you from going and telling you that you were making a huge mistake, that you would always regret, that you were throwing your life away and throwing away everything that they had ever done to help you in life, etc.?
You know what? Not at all. It was quite the opposite. They supported me. I love, there's a great story. Most of my teachers were supportive, but there was this one teacher that came up to me when I was saying goodbye, really, because I had graduated, I'm done. And she said, I feel that you're making a big mistake, and what is your plan B? I mean, do you have another plan if this doesn't work out? Like, what if it doesn't work out? And when I told my mom that, my mom went straight into the school and just said, how dare you say this to my son? What's your plan? What's your second plan? What if this doesn't work out for you? What's your plan B? And it was just so great to see my mom, take that control, because I've never seen her like that in my life. And it was just so great that they were supportive of going after dreams. And because if you don't, then what do you really have? You might as well just shoot for whatever you want to do.
Aaron Paul speaking to Terry Gross. He plays Jesse Pinkman in the AMC series Breaking Bad, which has its season finale next weekend. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, and Heidi Saman. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.